This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of the inaugural Royal Historical Society lecture at the German Historical Institute London, given by Claire Anderson, Professor of History at the University of Leicester, entitled Convicts, Creolization and Cosmopolitanism, Aftermaths of Penal Transportation in the British Empire. The RHS GHIL lecture is an annual event held each January, showcasing new research in global history.
Thanks so much for that really lovely welcome. I thought you might be a bit more forgiving if I stressed this was all new work. It's really exciting to have this opportunity to come and talk to such a wonderful audience virtually and face to face about this new project that I've been working on for the last 2.5 years. So in my lecture this evening, I'm going to be exploring some of the aftermaths of convict transportation to penal colonies and settlements across the former empire. Most people, I think, are familiar with the Australian colonies as destinations for convicts sentenced to transportation in Britain and Ireland. But less familiar, I think, are two things. The first is the global nature of convict transportation around the British Empire, which dates from the 17th century, and more especially for our purposes this evening, from British colonies, maybe in the Caribbean and Mauritius, to Australia. The second thing I think is less familiar are the parallel circuits that existed for Asian convicts sentenced to transportation in British India, which you can see represented here. And I've tried to pull together a graph here, the blue line representing the Australian colonial and British circuits, and the red line, the Asian circuits. But before I begin, we might focus on legacies, I'd like to offer some broad historical context. Between the late 18th and mid-20th centuries, the British transported over 250,000 convicts. Around 167,000 of them went to the Australian colonies, most in New South Wales, which then included part of what's now Queensland, and Van Diemen's Land, which is now Tasmania. Gaps in the records mean that it's difficult to say how many of these were of Asian, African, Creole, Pacific or Indigenous heritage, convicted either in Britain or in British colonies, but historians have estimated that they constituted perhaps 1% of the total, although my view is that the figure was perhaps somewhat less than this. This is a tiny number compared to the more than 100,000 Asian convicts that the British shipped to penal settlements around Southeast Asia and to Mauritius. The overwhelming majority of these were from British India, which of course also included Burma after annexation. And a few, perhaps less than 100, also came from Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. From the late 18th to the middle of the 19th century, convicts went to East India Company settlements. And after 1858, they went to the Andaman Islands. And the Andamans received in total more convicts than any single Australian colony, largely because it remained open as a penal colony right up until the Japanese occupation during World War II. Now, we know quite a lot about the history of what I'm going to call colonial convict transportation to the Australian colonies. So on this slide, you can see represented some of the figures. There's fascinating work on all of these people. And with other historians, I've asked lots of questions about this kind of transportation. Why was it used? What happened to colonial convicts after they arrived in penal colonies? Were prisons overcrowded? Were convict dumping grounds needed? How were penal colonies connected to colonial prison building programs, to judicial execution and to governance, including of enslaved, apprenticed and indentured labourers in plantation societies? What kind of work did these convicts do? Were they in possession of special skills or seen as such? How was it related to the expansion of colonial interest through tropical production? So lots of really interesting work in this area. Similarly, for Asian convict transportation, we've seen a focus on why the East India Company and later the British Crown used transportation. Again, how did it relate to colonial prisons in India? How did it relate to alternative punishments like judicial execution? And again, the expansion of plantation production, notably spices and sugar in this context. We've seen an interest in the life histories and experiences of all of these people, although the records for the Asian context mean that there are far fewer available to us than for Australia. So the figures represented here are by Maharaj Singh and Kurik Singh. In the middle, we have the 1857 rebel Liaquat Ali, who went to the Andamans. And then the final on the right is an anonymous convict. This photograph was taken in the 1890s in the Andamans, and I think the anonymity represents very well all that we cannot know about the Asian convicts. Now, I'm only touching on these histories here this evening, and if anybody wants an up-to-date bibliography, I've recently convened a roundtable in family and community history with some family historians. There are six authors, and there's a really up-to-date bibliography on all of these areas. So anyone looking for student reading lists, etc., or wanting to find out more can have a look at that piece. My point this evening is to think about what happened next. We don't fully understand colonial convict life courses, what happened to these convicts after their release, or to their descendants during the 19th and 20th centuries, right up to the present day. And I want to look at these aftermaths from three places that received convicts historically in the British Empire: Australia, Penang in Malaysia, and the Andaman Islands of India. And this will form the three sections of my talk this evening. I'll be drawing on materials gathered from historical work in archives and interviews and work with descendants and related communities. In recent years, historians and the descendants of British and Irish convicts in Australia have worked together in ways that have integrated individual, community, and academic perspectives. And I must here mention the pioneering work of Tanya Evans, and note also the lively online presence of some groups. Most people see the 1988 Australian Bicentennial as a turning point in creating a new openness about convicts and descendants and their role in the making of the Australian nation. Of course, this and Australia or Invasion Day were and remain enormously controversial in the context of settler colonialism and Indigenous dispossession. And I'll come back to this later in the first section of my paper in regard to what it means for writing family histories. Things are somewhat different in the Andamans, which is today part of the Republic of India. There, nation-making started with independence and partition in 1947. And the political incorporation of the islands as a union territory of India in 1952. At this time, over 70 years ago, as now, convict descendants were and are still celebrated as a proud, local-born community of freedom fighters and pioneer settlers. They were and still are sometimes called the pre-42s, 1942, being the year that the Japanese began their almost three-year occupation of the islands. And this occupation had important ramifications both for the islands' history and the way in which the previous two centuries of imperial history are represented. So this means that in the Andamans, in contrast to Australia, there were no silences or stains to be overcome in recovering a history of the penal colony, which, due to its recent past at the very moment of independence, was never denied. Instead, as we will see in section three of the paper, people in the islands pivot towards particular representations of their past. There's no equivalent in other British Indian penal settlements, including present-day Myanmar, Singapore, Malaysia, and Mauritius. And this is because over time, convicts and their descendants merged into multi-ethnic communities comprised of local peoples and other immigrants, including from India. So there are no recognisable or self-defining groups of convict descendants in these places. In Penang and Singapore, locals appreciate the past presence of convicts. You can see this represented in some really nice ironwork sculpture in Penang now. In a general sense, these communities include people descended from Indians and Malays. And in Penang, they're called the Jawi Peranakan, which in a general sense has a similar meaning to local born in the Andamans. And there are also communities descended from other Indian groups and in Mauritius, the wider Creole group. In terms of histories of descent, what unites the Asian cases and sets them apart from Australia are two things. The first is to do with proximity. Given the proximity of the penal colony locations to mainland India in Southeast Asia, at least some ex-convicts were able to return home. This was far less common in the Australian colonies. And the second is the destruction of records that occurred during the Japanese occupations of the Second World War. Compared to the possibilities of the rich convict and other records that are available for Australia, it's simply not possible for families in places like Singapore, Malaysia and the Andamans to reconstruct family trees. Only where narratives have been passed down uninterrupted over the generations can associations be made with individual ancestors. And at the present time, we've only found that this is the case in the Andamans. Even there, as one of our interlocutors told us, papers are so rare that they're like trophies. For the rest of Southeast Asia and Mauritius, convict descendants have almost certainly become integrated into larger communities, but we've got no way of tracking this historically. So I'm going to move to section one on Australia. And before I do, I would just like to thank the Leverham Trust, who's funding this project, as well as the University of Leicester for allocating some knowledge exchange and impact acceleration account funding to this work. And to my colleague at Leicester, Lorraine Patterson, who's the postdoc on this project, another colleague at Leicester, Kelly Moss, who's done the transcriptions, and my dear friend Tamsin O'Connor. We've been talking about black convicts for more years than either of us would care to remember. So, Australia. I want to begin this section by planting this image in your mind, the last captive Tasmanian tiger, which had been sold to the zoo in Hobart by twin brothers Roy and Gordon Delphine and their uncle Dan, who lived in Warrata in remote northwest Tasmania. They'd captured it using a treadle snare on the 7th of July 1930 and later showed it at Tasmania's Burney Show. A little while later, at some point in August, the brothers had snared a second female tiger, but she'd died. Roy told the family later that he knew that the creature shown in the photograph was his tiger because when he noticed it, he saw where the snare mark was on its leg. As for the dead female, Dan was said to have made a waistcoat out of its fur, and a family member has spoken about stories coming down about his pride at wearing it, although we don't know what happened to the garment. The survivor, meantime, this tiger died in the zoo in 1936, and a couple of years ago, its skin was found in a museum cupboard. Now, I'm sure you all know that the Tasmanian tiger, or thylacine, had been declared extinct, in fact, in 1982, although some people believe that it still survives. But what I am almost certain that you don't know is that the uncle and brothers Delphine were the descendants of a convict called Jerome Delphine, who was transported to Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, in 1844 and became known as John. Jerome had been enslaved in Mauritius and, like other enslaved people, was emancipated into the post-slavery system of apprenticeship in 1834. Accompanying him to the penal colony were his brother Augustine and a 14-year-old boy called Benjamin Zaire. Jerome had been convicted of stealing a trunk containing money and other goods, and his brother and Benjamin of complicity. Jerome got 10 years and Augustine and Benjamin got 7. Jerome later married a woman called Mary Kane and the couple had 9 children. And such a large family inevitably produced many descendants. One of the sons alone had over a dozen children, and this included Uncle Dan and his nephews Roy and Gordon, our tiger catchers. Now, the discovery of the connection between enslavement and its aftermath, the criminal justice system of Mauritius and the capture and sale of the last Tasmanian tiger links together huge themes in the history of empire and its aftermath: enslavement, emancipation, settler colonialism, and extinction. Who would have thought it? The descendant of an enslaved Mauritian wearing a Tasmanian tiger skin waistcoat in the remote northwest of this island of Tasmania in the 1930s. I'd started work on Mauritius way back when I was a PhD student and in the island's archives in the mid-1990s. My PhD was a study of the Indian penal settlement on the island, but I published some of these early findings in a 1999 article and then in my 2012 book, The Bolton Lives, which Emma mentioned. This focused on convict life histories in the Indian Ocean. Over the years, a few genealogists have got in touch with me when they saw in online extracts of these publications that I'd written about people who they knew were members of their family. And I was spurred on to pick up this work again when I was given Ian Duffield's unpublished papers after he died in 2019. Ian was one of my PhD supervisors, and though he was unable to publish his book before his death, through a series of publications dating from the 80s, he was, without question, the pioneer researcher of the colonial convicts. I tried to find the convicts that Ian and I had located in family trees on websites like Ancestry. I wrote about my interest for a Tasmanian genealogy magazine and did the same on Facebook groups. And once they got to learn about my work, my friends and colleagues in Australia were really generous in sharing details of their networks. And it's in this way that I came to be in touch with two descendants of the formerly enslaved Jerome Delfin. Their son and mother, Thomas and Kerry Heaviside, they've given me permission to use their real names, and I think they're Zooming in this evening. I got to meet them in Thomas's lovely home in a large town in the north of England. Jerome Delfin was Kerry's great-great-great-grandfather, and her father had emigrated to the UK in the 1960s. Thomas and Kerry both love history, and Kerry had enjoyed Who Do You Think You Are, both the book and the TV show, years ago. But Thomas took the lead on the family history research. Prior to this research, they had not known that they had a Mauritian ancestor. As well as his immediate family in the north of England, other branches live in Victoria and the Northern Territory, and I've recently learned that some have moved on to Western Australia. They told me that the Tasmanian group dropped the E to become Delfin, but the UK branch went by Delfine with the E. Many ex-convicts left Tasmania following abolition of transportation, joining the gold rush and hiding their origins to start new lives, and the Delfins, it seems, were no exception. Thomas's research was not without difficulty. He told me that as his work progressed and he discovered the family's Mauritian heritage, his granddad's sister stopped speaking to him because she'd always believed that the family had come from France. His granddad, on the other hand, was very, very excited. He always wanted to tell everyone. Previously, he'd believed the family had indigenous heritage, and his mother had also told him that their ancestors had immigrated from Portugal. At about this time, one Christmas, Thomas gifted genetic genealogy kits to the whole family. They were not entirely surprised by the results, which seemed to show a connection to Madagascar, with the proportions declining down the generations. And I don't have time to go into it this evening, it could be a whole paper, but genetic genealogy has emerged as this fascinating element of the project. Kerry told us that the discovery had enabled her to make sense of the teasing that she suffered as a child who was different to her friends at primary school. This was partly because she looked different to them, but it was also because she wasn't raised in an extended family as was common in the 1970s in this part of the UK. Phone calls and visits from her Australian family were always part of her life, but since her and Thomas have done their family tree, she's been granted Australian citizenship and proudly holds an Australian passport. As for the Mauritian connection, Kerry told us, if I say to someone, oh, I had an ancestor who was a slave and, you know, of colour, as they called it, of colour, they look at me and go, what? You know what I mean? It's odd. It feels like sometimes you're different, but then sometimes it's just so much to take in. If some of the colonial convict descendants moved to Britain, there are, of course, many more in Australia. And overall in Tasmania, it's estimated that at least a third of the population have at least one convict ancestor, though, of course, rather fewer have colonial convict roots, given the small numbers involved. The family histories that we've been working with have come from a wide range of backgrounds. A small minority have always known about their connections to other colonies, but like Kerry and Thomas, most have only recently discovered this aspect of their family's past. And this evening, in this first section, I've perhaps got time to touch on work with a couple of other families. So first, let me introduce you to Bevan and Nolene and their daughter Natalie. Again, I think they've zoomed in to join us all the way from Queensland, and they live in a beautiful part of the country called Marburg, just outside of Brisbane, which was known for sugarcane cultivation, including through Pacific Islander and Asian indentured labour historically. So the family had always been interested in family history, and it's since their retirement that they've found the time to undertake their research. And this coincided with Natalie's move to New South Wales, where she took the opportunity to visit the state archives. And to her astonishment, after just 90 minutes, with the help of the archivists, she discovered her connection to a Mauritian convict called John Victor through her father's line. That's Bevan. Australian sociologists have written about family historians' delight at finding a convict in the family. And as for a Mauritian convict, Nolene told us, we were amazed and we thought, well, how can this be? We just couldn't believe it. Echoing comments also made by Thomas and Kerry, Bevan told us that people had always thought that his sister was an Indigenous Australian. They'd spent time in Malaya when they were children and their father was in the forces. And Bevan told us that the family nanny would dress her up in a sari and pass her as an Indian girl. In other interviews that we have done, this point has come across so strongly. Numerous descendants have told us that they didn't know about their colonial origins and had always believed themselves to be of Indigenous heritage, all that family stories had connected them to Maori, Fijian or Indian people, in one case a princess. So the Victor family's ancestor, John Victor, has an interesting history. He was just 15 when he was sentenced for burglary in 1839 alongside 18-year-old Eugène Doucette, more on whom anon. Now, there is no evidence that either man had been enslaved. And in the Mauritian records, they're described as Creoles in service, not apprentices or ex-apprentices, which would indicate former enslavement. Both men arrived in Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, and just a month later they were moved north to what's now Queensland with 13 other Mauritian convicts. And this was against the background of the mass transfer of 31 of the 69 Caribbean convicts then on the island who had suffered greatly in the cold. So they were all moved north, as were the Mauritians. They were given the choice. They were not forced to go. Now, Bevan stressed in our work how lucky Victor had been. We think it's really special and we just can't believe our luck that we're here on this earth, he said. And in many ways, their family is typical in its successes and challenges over time. The beautiful family history book that the couple have written and illustrated for their grandchildren tells us all about Victor's acquisition of land and later generations' families, business successes and military service. We know that the wider family raised children when parents died. And in fact, Bevan's father also died when he was a teenager. So we can acknowledge the difficulties and celebrate the successes of families like the Delphins and the Victors. But as historians and sociologists have stressed, and as Bevan is well aware of in his realisation of the family's luck, in part because of very skewed gender ratios, and in part because of the physical toll of transportation and hard labour, most male convicts did not have children. So it's important to recognise that when we celebrate the family histories of colonial convicts in Australia, we're also celebrating the exceptions, not the norm. I don't want to suggest that family formation is the only measure of success, of course. There's a general problematic of family trees constructing Eurocentric and heteronormative ideas of family itself, which, as many people have pointed out, rubs up against the realities of lives and sexualities, including through a more capacious understanding of kinship, where people are related to each other, but not through bloodlines. So just to mention very quickly, I mentioned Eugène Doucette. That's on the right there, you see Stradbroke Island. And Eugène Doucette ran away and joined an Indigenous group there and ended up as a translator for the British between Indigenous people and the British in the courts. And I wanted to raise this example because it may well, of course, be the case that he had a family with an Indigenous woman, but these histories are not available to us, even through trying to do oral histories, not available. So it's an important point to make. And just, I couldn't resist putting Johnny Cassin, very famous in Queensland, the slide of his hotel there. All of that said, it's also important to recognise historically that convicts from the colonies and their descendants have faced challenges connected not just with the stigma of convictism or convict heritage, which of course applies for all people with convict roots potentially, but with the politics and impacts of Indigenous marginalisation, the White Australia policy and associated restrictions on immigration that followed Federation in 1901, as well as the more general drive for social and cultural assimilation that followed World War II. The politics of race has emerged as an important theme in our interviewing work, and we've learned a lot from family historians who shared stories. Some families have come to understand that the racial politics of Australia encouraged their ancestors to lose their colonial convict heritage. And they've told us that learning about this colonial heritage has enabled them to make sense of puzzles in their family history, including shape-shifting, name-changing, and the disappearance of family members, and in some cases, what they know to be the fabrication of civil records. So we might argue then that the politics of post-convict settler colonial Australia have produced obfuscations in colonial convict genealogies reflected in the archives themselves and ultimately in the stories that families tell and withhold. With these issues in mind, in this last part on Australia, I've got time to talk about one other Australian family this evening, which I think is a lucky escape you all, because I've got 20, so we've only looked at three. But I want to look at this family because they're connected to a formerly enslaved convict transported from Barbados to Van Diemen's Land. Prince Moody was sentenced after abolition when, like the Delphin brothers in Mauritius, he became an apprentice. His descendant, Tony Birch, the famous Indigenous writer, told me he'd always known about his Caribbean convict heritage. And this was in large part because of his closeness to his great-great-uncle, Les Moody, who's better known as the Australian champion bantamweight boxer, Ranji. And Tony told me that this Indian name was a conscious effort on the part of some family members to claim Indian heritage for themselves. And they did actually have a Punjabi ancestor too, but to distance themselves from their Indigenous and Caribbean origins. And Tony finds this deeply perplexing because not only was his uncle Les a really terrific sportsman, he was also really well known. He was a sports writer for the Sporting Globe in Melbourne, for example. And this was remarkable for a man who, as Tony told me, had faced intense racism throughout his career. But as Tony put it, explaining how part of the family's distanced itself from what he called their mongrel origins, the notion that we would have any shame around colour is ridiculous. But the real issue there is for them to recognise us, they would have to recognise themselves. Now, after I first contacted Tony, he went to see a woman called Anya, who he described to me as a very important Indigenous matriarch community in Melbourne. She'd been a great friend of his great-grandmother, and he asked her about his family. He told me, she said, without missing a beat, "Well, I know that your grandmother's family were from the West Indies and Aboriginal people." And then she started to tell me about a Jamaican side of her own family. And she said there's a whole connection between these people and Aboriginal people. And as you can see here, Tony's a really terrific poet. And this poem on the right is about Prince Moody. I'm sorry for my scribbles. I couldn't find a clean copy without my scribbles on. So Tony and I talked about so many things, including the difference between biological and cultural relatedness. But the thing I'd like to touch on this evening is to do with the stolen generations, when between 1910 and 1970, government forcibly removed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families. Tony highlighted the important identity work that had taken place at this time, describing his grandmother, who died in 1990, as the most evasive person I have ever met. He said, "To identify or to be identified as non-white at this time, when you can pass, why would you?" He's told me stories of how Indigenous fathers were left off official forms because mothers feared their children would be taken away. He held out the same point as relevant to colonial families, themselves sometimes blended with Indigenous people. And this has emerged in so many other interviews that we've done, including the descendant of another Barbados convict, Robert James. And you can read the thoughts of his descendant in the round table that I mentioned earlier. The same theme emerges. For Tony, it's these fallible European record sets, his words, which explain the erasure of colonial convict histories in most families. They've only survived in his because of the importance of storytelling, which he connects not just to his Indigenous heritage, but to working class culture. He told me that he was amazed at how the largely middle class students he teaches at the University of Melbourne know about their family histories. Australia is built on secrets and lies, he said, summing it up neatly. It's a bit like sitting around a family table, and someone in the family knows that someone across it had an illegitimate child, and no one ever speaks about it, but everyone knows it. So I'll next move on to my section on Penang. So this is an image here of a Kramat, a shrine on Transfer Road in what is now part of Georgetown's UNESCO World Heritage Site. And you can see here juxtaposed a historical image of the Kramat from the turn of the century with the inside of the shrine, a photograph I took last year next to two banners, which are part of a sympathetic recent restoration. And I just want us to think back to a point I made at the start of my talk, that currently there are no acknowledged genealogies of convict descent in Malaysia because the Indian convicts blended in to local people with local peoples and other labour migrants. So if the Australian part of this work has been about tracing specific genealogies to think through larger historical issues which still matter now, the Penang work has become focused on one sole man and his importance to contemporary politics and communities over time. So the Kramat is the burial place of a man called Syed Mustafa Idris, known as the Dato Khoya. And historically and now, it's commonly understood that he was a convict from India. Though associated with Sufi Islam, as in similar sites across South and Southeast Asia, and in fact further afield, the Kramat attracts peoples from all communities and faiths. They come to pray about a range of personal challenges, the passing of exams, securing of jobs, marriage and children. And in fact, we learned during our interviews in Penang that the name Khoya is a middle name for girl and boy babies alike. We literally stumbled across this site. Actually, there's another paper in that, but anyway, in December 2022. And what immediately interested us about it is its association with Penang's convict history. So Penang received at least 5,500 Indian convicts in the first half of the 19th century. Two interesting features are that the most common conviction was for murder, which was not the case for Australia at all. And second, that gender ratios were even more skewed than in Australia. And in Penang, according to my counting of ship records, less than 100 women in total were ever sent there. So we were able to meet and talk to the community that looks after the site, including the remarkable Adam Malik, who was on the Dato Khoya Heritage Committee. And through Adam, we met Gwyn Jenkins, a Malaysia-based British architect who oversaw the renovation shortly before the pandemic. And we learned a huge amount about the site from them, as also from the writings of a Penang-based historian called Khoo Salma Nasution. The first archives about the Dato could be found in the writings of a famous traveller called Ibrahim Munshi. He visited Penang in 1872 and was told that the Dato was a Said from Malabar. He wrote that he'd been told that the Dato had been transported because he'd found a dead body in a ditch and he'd bathed and shrouded it ready for burial, but he was arrested for murder and then sent overseas. And the Munshi really stressed that the case was not clear, but nonetheless he was transported. He spent 7 years as a convict but was released as an old man. He asked for alms and was given money and rice, and every day he would gather children together and feed them. He died about 5 years later. A few years after his burial, according to the Munshi, local people heard the sound of mystic exercises being chanted near the grave, and the gravestones parted so that his grew in length. And in Malaysian beliefs, this is a sign that the burials are Kramat. So following this, the Munshi wrote, locals commemorated the death anniversary each year. They chanted prayers, they performed rituals, they lit lamps, they set off fireworks, they left coconuts and flowers, and they threw a feast. They also told stories of miracles. A century later, in 1974, a caretaker who had worked at the Kramat since the 1930s told a team of researchers from the Malayan Teachers College the same stories, and added that there were no written records, but the Dato had died in about 1840. Oral histories about the site, like these, have been passed down generation to generation, particularly by women. And in 2015, a Penang-based organisation, Think City, updated the 1974 teacher's story, noting other oral histories about the Dato's magical powers. He could feed large numbers of people with a tiny pot of porridge. He could take sweets out of his mouth for children. And he could escape from jail and complete arduous road building work overnight. We also learned in our interviews that the Dato appears to people in their dreams, guiding them towards resolutions in difficult matters. People today believe that when the Dato was alive, he would go around houses and people would give him rice, peppers, salt and oil, and he would cook those and share them from his tiny pot to these large dishes. And so now when people go to the site to seek blessings, they lay these things by the graveside. There have been a few changes to practice. There used to be an oil lamp. It was believed that that oil could cure illness if it was placed on the body, but that is no longer there. But it's also believed that the cloth covering the shrine, when it's changed, it brings good luck to whoever takes it home. Now, in her work on the history of the Kramat, Kuselma makes the important point that local communities, even if they're unconnected to convicts, can easily identify with the story of an exploited convict worker. And this is why the site has become so culturally powerful. In the context of multi-ethnic Malaysia, she writes, the site was seen as a common point of allegiance for the three community groups. So here she means Malays, Indians and Chinese. So despite the vibrant and dynamic oral histories, which incidentally are reported in a couple of really interesting newspaper features in the 20th century, when we met them in Penang, the community that looks after the site didn't know if the Dato really was a convict or really any details about him at all. So I offered to try and find him in the archives. I have hundreds of Indian convict records, probably thousands actually, which I've been collecting since the late 90s. Although the archives are quite fragmented, some of the best records are convict ship lists with names, crimes, sentences, place of origin, etc. And I thought if we're really lucky, we might just find his name in one of these lists. Even if we couldn't find the Dato as a convict in the archives, I knew I had something to offer the community in terms of understanding the broader convict histories that surround the area in which the Kramat's situated. And as I mentioned at the start of the lecture, during the Second World War, many records were destroyed. So the very best evidence that we have about the penal settlements in this part of the world are held not far from here in the India Office collection of the British Library, as well as in the Indian sending locations. So West Bengal, Maharashtra, Tamil Nadu State Archives, which were all the capitals of the historic presidencies. So with all of this in mind, I set to work in my search for the Dato. I spent weeks, laborious weeks, looking through Word documents, Excel spreadsheets and photographs. And I went back to the India Office to look at more papers, because remember, I began all this work in the days before digital photography. And I found a name which matches the oral histories. It was in an 1834 list appended to the very famous Indian Prison Discipline Report of 1838, not in the digitized papers, which you can find online, but in a paper appendix held in the India Office that I'd photographed and filed away some years ago. And I'm really not sure why, but this appendix includes some detailed information about the convicts in Penang sent from the Madras Presidency, which you can see represented on the map here. So this list records that one Saeed Mustafa was convicted of murder in Salem, which is in the middle of the Madras Presidency, on the 27th of December 1827 and sentenced to life. When the list was drawn up in 1834, he was an invalid, so he was elderly or sick and didn't have to work, and under the convict class system, belonged to the fifth class. So this all fits with the oral histories. So working back from this list, I hope to find Saeed Mustafa in records of shipments. And these are included in judicial consultations volumes held up the road and also in the Tamil Nadu State Archives, where I happen to have worked on those volumes too. So I've looked at both parallel sets. But the lists sometimes are missing in both places. And unfortunately, there was no record of this man's shipment after his conviction in December 1827 or for the whole of 1828. We can infer a few things. So like all Madras convicts transported during this period, he would have been tattooed on the forehead in a process known as Godna, with his name, crime and date of sentence. And despite the missing ship list, we can assume he was part of a gang of 14, which was received in Madras for shipment in July 1828. Because letters in another series tell us that three East India Company ships arrived in Penang simultaneously. The McQueen had carried 100 goats fresh from the jungle, but most had died on the way. The Marquis of Huntly was carrying the Right Reverend Lord Bishop of Calcutta, and he was also dead on arrival. And the Lord Lowther had the convicts on board, and I think it was that ship that carried Saeed Mustafa. And the Penang newspapers confirm the arrivals, and the factory records of everyday admin complain that there was no convict list. So that explains why we don't have a list in the archives, right? When I told my friend Marcus Langdon in Penang the story of the dead goats, the dead bishop and the Dato Khoya, he couldn't believe it. He kindly shared with me some details from his forthcoming book on art in Penang. It seems that the dead bishop's young widow, Marianne James, painted 20 watercolours of Penang during her 2 months' stay on the island with her young son while her husband was buried and before she could return to England. And like Saeed Mustafa, we know this from the newspapers, they had to wait 2 or 3 days for disembarkation, and she painted a picture of what she could see from the ship, which is the view that would have greeted Saeed Mustafa, if I'm right, as well as herself. And the National Maritime Museum happens also to have a picture of the Lord Lowther sailing out of Penang Harbour. Annual returns of convicts, including death, were returned to India from all the penal settlements, but most of these were never printed in the volumes. And so it's been impossible for me to find any further records in the very patchy annual returns that have survived either in Chennai or here in London. However, the caretaker's oral history transmission of a death in 1840 accords with what we do know. Certainly, this Saeed Mustafa was an invalid in 1834, and we know he died before 1854 because, conveniently for the historian, the superintendent of police mentioned the existence of the Cramat in 1854. During the renovation, the community found underneath the burial shroud a land transfer document, and I've just put a little bit of this here. And this mentions the Dato Khoya too. It's in fact dated 1875, and it mentions an original grant of 1824 for purposes unknown, which we are all really trying to get a hold of. The person who transferred the land matches the name of another convict. There are two names, they both match, but of course, you know, it doesn't mean it's them, right? But they do, the people who owned this plot of land do match convict names. So yeah, but we don't want to, two and two doesn't make four, right? So we went to Penang for a second time and presented our findings to Adam and the community. And we've been really overwhelmed by their response and about the relationship that we've built with them. And Adam, as well as the session that we ran, Adam has run further community briefings for community members. And Adams told us that although the Indian community that lives in the neighbourhood takes care of the site, they feel it belongs to all Malaysians. And the wider context here is really important. Following the emergency and then independence in 1957, there's been a resurgence of Islamic politics in Malaysia. And since the 1970s, the idea of being Malay has become narrower and more exclusive. So rather than stressing the cosmopolitanism of the Malay people, to be a Bumiputra, a Malay person or son of the soil in modern Malaysia defines citizenship and enables access to economic forms of participation in the nation. And Tim Harper has described Bumiputra as an ideological cornerstone of the modern Malaysian state, and it excludes people of other heritage unless they marry in. So the small piece of the historical jigsaw that our knowledge of and access to British archives has offered this group has constituted a powerful historical archive with enormous contemporary relevance. Penang's always been a bit different to the rest of Malaysia. It's a multi-ethnic melting pot with a long history of regional connection and mobility. And we've brought further nuance to this by showing through archives that are not available there that the Indian community, whether descended from convicts or not, has a very long history that can be evidenced name by name in paperwork in London and India. And through the Datuk Koya Shrine, we can route this very precisely to a material presence in the heart of the Georgetown World Heritage Site. People in Penang know about the island's convict history, but there's an unspoken assumption that convicts either died or were repatriated. And our work has challenged this. We've shown the Koya community, the Datuk Koya community, records of the earliest arrivals and lists of over 500 convicts or probationary convicts who were living there in the 1870s. And we know from these lists that some of them were married and some of them had children. We also know they owned land and livestock. They became priests, traders, and even government contractors. And we know that the last Indian convict still alive, a woman, in fact, didn't die until 1911. What we cannot know are the lines of descent from these people, but in a general sense, we can root this presence historically, and this has really important implications for belonging in Malaysia now. So I'm going to turn to my final section on the Andamans. Before I do, there are some really interesting convict cremats all over the place. So this, the Mazar, this is in the Andaman Islands. I've written about this place before. It's a fascinating site. Also, a convict is buried there. I showed the photograph of Liaquat Ali, the 1857 rebel. He has a cremat too. It's called the Mazar. And then you remember the picture of Bhai Maharaj Singh and his disciple Karat Singh. Bhai Maharaj Singh has a gurdwara in Singapore. And in both of these places, miracles happen. It's really fascinating. But I must move on. So, okay, the Andamans. So now we turn to the final section. So as I mentioned earlier, the islands were a penal colony for a century, from 1857 to the Second World War. And I also mentioned that convict history has never been forgotten in the islands, but rather that descendants were and are celebrated as proud local-born community of freedom fighters and pioneered settlers. Now, in my lecture so far, I've tried to talk about work with individuals, families, and a community in Australia and Penang, and to think about how histories of colonial and Asian transportation matter for how we understand the politics of the past and present. I'm writing a new history of local-born descent and descendants, including through interviews for the Andamans. And I actually first began interviewing in the Andamans more than a decade ago, and I first visited over 20 years ago. But what I thought I'd do in the final section of the paper is to look at the history of the memorialisation of convict history. So we go from individuals and families to communities to government agendas since India's independence in 1947, and what this means for our understanding of a different kind of aftermath of penal transportation. So again, thinking back to this important point I made at the beginning, during the Second World War, records were destroyed, and this was also the case in the Andaman Islands when the Japanese occupied 1942-5. The destroyed records include everything that was kept in the cellular jail, as well as family papers. And over the years, the families that I know in the islands have told me that they burned their papers because they were frightened the Japanese would accuse them of spying for the British. So they burned anything that they had. In the absence of individual penal colony records of the kind that we see in Australia, and even to some degree in Penang, I've found that local-born people adopt two strategies in representing their history. Either they align themselves with general histories of anti-colonial rebellion, or they stress that their ancestors were transported for honour crimes. So commonly, local-born people, the descendants of convicts, call themselves mutineers, patriots, rebels, and/or victims. One complicating factor in this representation are divergent views about what freedom fighting is. And the mainland, as islanders call the mainland of India, view freedom fighters very differently to the islanders. They view freedom fighters as the few hundred nationalist heroes who were incarcerated in the cellular jail, mainly in the 20th century. Islanders define freedom fighting as an aspect of the 1857 uprising, or crimes generally committed under colonial law, colonial occupation, or more recently of membership of the Indian Independence League or Indian National Army during the Japanese occupation. The atrocities of the Japanese became clear over this time, and in some cases, local-born people switched sides. So freedom fighting can also be seen as resistance against the Japanese. These complexities and this breach between mainland and island views has never been fully resolved, producing what myself and my two co-authors called in a 2014 book, a complex landscape of belonging. Now, we learned at the start of my lecture about the local-born association. So I showed the historic image and the dinner recently. And the local-born association was and remains a forum that pushes for the representation and incorporation of pre-42 descendants into politics and society. And those of you familiar with India will understand the importance of the association's success in achieving so-called scheduled caste status for itself. This means that government jobs are reserved and there's also access to mainland education. And here I want to note also that after independence, the association underwent name changes that were connected to the way it tried to see itself. So it morphed from the Local Born Association to the Andaman Indian Association to the Andamanian Association and back to the Local Born Association. And I think this is a really important metaphor for how people try to position themselves in the islands over time. During work in the islands last year, 10 years on since I last carried out interviews in Port Blair, I was struck that young people that we met were again calling themselves Andaman Indians and the name local born was being dropped. So over time, state-sanctioned commemoration in the Andaman Islands has worked through some of the identities and relationships at stake. On the 15th of August 1947, the Local Born Association was at the heart of the celebrations. It organised a five-day programme of entertainment, flag-hoisting, music, distribution of sweets, a feast, an exhibition hockey match, and my favourite, a fancy dress show. It also marked the 25th anniversary of independence with a similar series of events, again including a flag-hoisting ceremony, this time a ceremony in commemoration of the martyrs, i.e. the nationalists, at the central tower of the cellular jail. It also offered prizes for the three best decorated shops in the Aberdeen Bazaar of Port Blair, and those present were instructed to make a solemn pledge to serve India and contribute to world peace. These celebrations were not without controversy. 10 years after independence in 1957, the government of India ordered plaques to the leaders of the Indian freedom movement, including in the Andamans. But because there were no surviving records, the island administration couldn't propose any locals for inscription. In any case, it wasn't enthusiastic. The chief commissioner wrote, "A kind of sentiment is being woven on the mainland around the cellular jail, irrespective of the fact that it harboured several thousand hardened criminals. It does not deserve the honour which sentimental persons would like to bestow on it." However, the plaques went ahead, and it was in this context that the local government put up a masonry column which celebrated the heroes of what it called the National Revolution of 1857. It was unable to name individuals. The heroes are a collective. It's also notable that nobody from the mainland came to the opening. It was all locals at that opening compared to the activities at the cellular jail. Even in the inscription of the plaques, which you can see here, there were difficulties. Some of the so-called patriots came from areas that were now in Pakistan post-partition. So could or should they be appropriated as Indians? The list took years to compile, and it was only completed 12 years later, at about the same time that the cellular jail became a national memorial, which it remains today. And at about this time, what was called the Fraternity Circle of Andaman Freedom Fighters, based in Calcutta, began to make annual visits, calling these trips pilgrimages of salvation. They were elaborate affairs, hospitality, dinner, ceremonies, new statues, state receptions, etc. And at this time, a cell was set up to the famous nationalist B.D. Savarkar. In fact, he was moved around the jail to stop him forming relationships with people in adjoining cells. So it's kind of interesting that there's one cell that's picked out as the V.D. Savarkar cell that people go and pay their respects in. So in all these ways, mainland freedom fighters incarcerated in the Andamans became the creators of a free India. But at the same time, in this commemorative agenda, the ordinary convicts of the islands were forgotten, including even those sent after the Great Uprising of 1857. Even the extraordinary assassination of the Viceroy, the Earl of Mayo, in 1872 by convict Sher Ali was never mentioned. Also absent were convict, ex-convict and descendant support for mainland nationalists in the cellular jail, their activities with the Indian National Army and their activities with or against the Japanese during the Second World War. In 1973, the deputy commissioner even wrote, there were no reportable patriotic activities in this Union territory. Despite its refusal to acknowledge islanders' roles in either resisting transportation to the penal colony or in the larger struggle for independence, the mainland was keen to celebrate the heroic importance of the Indian National Army leader, Subhas Chandra Bose. And in the mid-1970s, this enormous statue was commissioned and put up in Marina Park in Port Blair, looking out to sea just below the cellular jail. And there's some evidence of islander unease at the development of this agenda. In 1976, the islands unanimously advised the central government against proposed name changes to either Swaraj Dweep, self-rule islands, or Shahid Dweep, martyr islands, or naming islands after famous nationalists like Netaji Savarkar, Bhai Parmanand, or both. The chief secretary wrote in 1976, this would hurt the sentiments of the local people. I end this section and the paper by making the point that with the election of Narendra Modi as India's prime minister in 2014, under a Hindu nationalist agenda, once again, great stress has been laid upon the Andamans as a site of anti-British struggle. On the 30th of December 2018, the Indian government renamed the islands in the Andamans just as it had been proposed in 1976. So whilst the islands as a group, the archipelago is still called the Andamans, Ross Island, Neal Island and Havelock Island are now called Subhas Chandra Bose Island, Shahid Dweep and Swaraj Dweep. And at this time, Modi visited. He saluted the Bose statue and he oversaw the putting up of a huge flag on the shoreline. It's absolutely huge. As an islander grumbled to us in November, this wasn't the place where Bose had actually raised the Indian tricolour during the Second World War, but in a much more prominent position. When I went to see my friends who work at the cellular jail, I caught a glimpse of a thick pile of government correspondence awaiting deposit in the Secretariat archives. The title said, On the Proposal to Rename the Islands. Of course I couldn't look at it, but I can't wait. I want to find out again what the debates and the controversies were, but there's a 30-year closure rule. So we all laughed as I made a date to go back when I'm in my 80s. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.